It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll be joined by the Wisconsin band Phox. That's P-H-O-X. They'll be sharing some stories and playing a few songs for us as well.
But first, the new Lone Ranger movie hit theaters last week. While Armie Hammer plays the title character, much more attention is being paid to Johnny Depp, who takes on the title role of Tonto.
We ride for justice.
Justice is what I seek, Kimosabe.
And our next guest says that is not okay, that we should not be willing to let Hollywood cast non-Native actors as Native American characters. Sonny Skyhawk is a veteran actor and the founder of American Indians in Film and Television, and his recent piece, What's Wrong with Benicio del Toro and Johnny Depp Playing Indian Characters, is linked to from the Central Time Facebook page. Sonny, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Gene. It's a pleasure.
Well, it is a pleasure to have you here. And I want to start out with a little bit of history here, because I have to say, in 2013, is it hard for you to imagine that we are still having this discussion?
Well, that's the unfortunate part, that little has been learned over the last 100 years about the American Indian people, I think, at least enough to understand that what's portrayed or defined by Hollywood is not really who we are as Native people.
Now, in your piece, one of the issues that you raise, one of the questions is, why are non-Native actors playing Indian roles when there is an abundance of capable actors who are available with just as much talent and skills? And you say that you've posed this question to network and to studio executives. So when you pose this question to them, when you're sitting in the room with them or sending them an email, what kind of response do you get?
Well, it's obviously a very negative response, mainly because Hollywood is interested in one thing and one thing only, and that's making money. Now, if you were to put a character or a figure out there from outer space, they could care less. It's what they care about is how much money is this movie going to make the studio or the network. And that's all they care about, whether it happens to be a real Native person playing that role or not. It's immaterial to them. And that leads us to the history of Hollywood that has forever, from the beginning of the kinetoscope, which is around 1898, which is perfected as the camera, what is now the camera. They've used the images of American Indians in those days. But ever since then, through the silence and the talkies, they utilized everybody and anybody that was under contract to any of the studios, including various people. Michael and Sarah comes to mind, that played Geronimo and Cochise for many years and made a great living out of playing Native characters, and yet obviously was Middle Eastern and not Native American. And there's just a whole bunch of actors that were on contract during that time that played Native people. So fast forward to 2013, and here again we find ourselves with Johnny Depp, which in this case has sunk to new depths, if you will, to have play on words. But that's the dilemma that we find ourselves in. And we talked to Disney. We cajoled them into not doing that, and let them know that we have more than maybe 15 or 20 actors that could fulfill that role. But again, it comes down to money. And Disney was having derived some $7.5 billion from the making of Pirates of the Caribbean, basically were indebted to Johnny Depp. And if he wanted to play Tonto, they were going to allow him to play Tonto.
And in fact, you know, Johnny Depp was asked about this. I mean, this has been the subject of some controversy. And he said he took on the role of Tonto to actually counteract the stereotypical images of Native Americans often seen in our culture and in film. So if you had an opportunity to sit with Johnny Depp in a room and he said that to you, how would you react to that?
Well, not that I'm looking forward to sitting with Johnny Depp in the very near future, especially since we've been adamantly opposed to this film. But the bottom line is that there's nothing, if you've seen the film or are going to see the film, there's nothing in the film itself that ingratiates the American Indian people. The fact that he wears this crow, dead crow on his head, I mean, that has nothing to do with our culture, with any of our cultures. And so making fun of the American Indian, creating another stereotype of the American Indian, definitely doesn't meet our approval.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the idea of stereotypes in Native Americans, stereotypes in the movies. One of the questions I've got for you is there a difference in your mind between movies? And let me sort of back up for a second with that, because we're talking about the Lone Ranger, and everybody knows that at some level the Lone Ranger is kind of a romp, that it's not to be taken seriously. But you can think of other movies that are to be taken very seriously. Is there a difference in your mind in a non-serious movie versus a serious movie, or is it all the same? Does the depiction of a Native American movie in a romp do just as much damage as the false depiction of a Native American in another more serious film?
Well, first of all, you can't take Hollywood seriously about anything. That's not what Hollywood intends to do. Seriousness, they leave that up to documentarians to make. So Hollywood, again, is all about profit. It's all about that profit picture, the profit margins of the studios and networks. So it has nothing to do with telling the truth about a people or anything like that. So you have to start off with that mindset to begin with. Now, the Western in itself was created by Hollywood. Tonto and the Lone Ranger was another fictionalized series that was created by Hollywood and radio back in the 1930s. So it has a long record of existence. But again, the character of Tonto being subservient to the Lone Ranger, that has existed for ever since it was invented. So most of the films that you see or Westerns that you've seen and have been around forever always show the American Indian as being the savage heathen going around killing and pillaging for no reason whatsoever. And so Hollywood invented that protagonist and continues to show our people in that light. And today, again, in 2013, we're not, as Native people, willing to go along with that any longer. We are doctors and lawyers and teachers and cab drivers and you name it, part of mainstream America. But yet when audiences see these films, like The Lone Ranger or any other film, they internalize that character or the characters in it. So today we're still caught in this time warp of being that savage heathen instead of the mainstream people that we are today. Your neighbor might be an American Indian, but that's what I'm saying, is that the stereotypes do nothing to advance the image of our people in modern society. And that's the unfortunate part, because, as I mentioned, when people see these films, they know that it's a film, they know that it's make-believe, but yet they internalize those people, and that's where the crux is.
Before we have to go, has anybody gotten this right in terms of a movie or a television show or something like that, where you've been able to look up at the screen and say, you know what, that is an accurate reflection of who we are?
I think I have to go back to 1993 and a movie that was called Geronimo, an American Legend. That movie basically told the story of the Apache people and Geronimo himself, and the fact that this was one tribe that struggled to retain and their lands and who they were as a people, and yet in the end, after having been used by the United States Army as scouts, were stripped of their dignity and who they were, and put in a prison in Florida for the next 5 or 8 years, and eventually ended up at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. But that's probably the only film in modern history that I'm aware of, besides Dances with Wolves. And again, all of these movies have to have this savior character, Kevin Costner in Dances with Wolves. And here again, we have this film. But in all the films, it always seems like there has to be this white savior, so to speak, that saves the day. And that's, again, what kind of makes this whole fictionalized world of Hollywood somewhat difficult for us to understand. Now, all I'm saying basically is the response that Tonto and the Lone Ranger has received only exemplifies the fact that people aren't going to accept that any longer. So the only profit, unfortunately, that Disney is going to reap from this is the licensing fees for the Halloween costume that will appear from now on. And that's about it, because I think they're going to take a bath on this to the tune of some $200-something million.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Sonny, thanks so much for joining us today.
I thank you very much, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Sonny Skyhawk is a veteran actor, and he is the founder of American Indians in Film and Television. Coming up, we'll be kicking back with some conversation and some live music with members of the up-and-coming Wisconsin-based band Fox. I'm Gene Purcell, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm here filling in for Rob Ferret this week. Right now, Central Time is proud to say hello to our first ever live band. So let's toss it over to Veronica Rickert, who is in our Buck studio right now with the up-and-coming band Fox.
Thank you, Gene. The band Fox is starting to turn heads, both here in Wisconsin and beyond. Fox had a coveted slot in the prestigious South by Southwest Musical Festival this year and got a thumbs up on NPR's All Songs Considered. And we've got with us in the studio today Monica Martin, Matt Roberts, Jack Johnston, Dave Roberts, Matt Holman, Cheston Van Huss, and Jason Krunfus. And guys, welcome. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Well, I want to start things off with a song. Monica, what are you going to play for us?
Away in the hour toward the middle of the night, we met our ends, and despite our wicked fire, and we will soar all the way around the soulfulness that all our dreams have grown around.
was amazing. Thank you so much. Monica, what was the name of that song again?
It's called 1936.
1936. Where did that one come from?
Oh, well, I was thinking a lot about family, and I probably projected some weirdness about my family onto my sister. It was kind of about family weirdness and looking at my sister, and I don't know. That's very vague, but my
family
sister's
weirdness.
Awesome.
I think people
She's
can
great.
Relate to family weirdness.
I think most people can, yeah.
Well, I like that one. It's beautiful. And I know, Matt Holman, we're going to be talking with you two today. And I understand that all of you share a place together. You live together, right?
That is correct.
How did that come to be? Were you a band first or were you roommates first?
They kind of assisted one another. I don't think if we didn't live together, if we lived apart, it would be really tough to get everyone to get out and go to a practice space and play or something like that.
We're lethargic.
That's another way of putting it, I suppose. But I think the big thing for us is, you know, we're all living in Baraboo, and we all kind of crash-landed our lives one way or the other, besides Monica and Zach, and we just wanted to get out, you know, and move to the big city and, you know, experience all the whitewater rafting. And,
that is so prevalent in Madison.
It is. It's very prevalent, as we all do know. So that was kind of the idea. It was like, let's move out. Let's, like, go play music if we want to. And then, you know, people started encouraging us a little bit more, and that's kind of what kick-started the band into a higher gear. It was just a good response from our friends.
And you played South by Southwest. That's a big deal for, I guess, a young band. This is your first album. What was this like, being at South by Southwest? Can you describe it?
Oh, man. Well, I think we had a really special experience because of our friend Sean Moeller and, you know, everyone over at Daytrotter. And they hooked us up and introduced us. Actually, they introduced us to NPR. So we did get down there, and it was really special. It's hard to navigate that space. You know, there are just many humans.
You just let it come to you. That was kind of our resolve. It's impossible to herd 7 cats into a van. Cats, like cool cats, like herding cats, like house cats.
Yeah. Less fun. The less fun kind of cat. Right. Well, I want to hear more about that, but I also want to hear more of your music before we go in and catch up on the latest news. So can you take us out to the news with another song? What are you going to play?
Sure. The song is called The Slow Motion.
In slow motion, I don't know what to say. Everywhere I fall, don't know name or location. Maybe I'll just find my way, I'll find it. Years ago now, I couldn't hold my eyes to the stars, but by they slept so far away, I see now. This is better in so many ways. All that glitter is fire, burns the skin when you see the face. Say everywhere I fall, don't know name or location. Maybe I'll just find my way, I'll find it. Heavy is my sleep and air is my dreaming. All you pretty through the night, it's because the salt that rolls off my cheek. Only you know why I cry.
I'm Veronica Rickert with Jean Purcell, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with the indie band Fox this hour. Fox had a big year. They played at the prestigious South by Southwest Music Festival and got a feature on NPR's All Songs Considered, and they're based in Madison, Wisconsin. They're all from Baraboo, but living in Madison now. And we've got the whole crew with us today. You've got singer Monica Martin, Matt Roberts, Zach Johnston, Dave Roberts, Matt Holman, Cheston Van Huss, and Jason Krunf is with us. And we just heard, I don't know, is it fair to call that one of your greatest hits, Slow Motion?
Well, that will be the title of our next record.
We're thinking.
Greatest Hits. That's greatest hits.
You're jumping right to the greatest hits. I like
it. Yeah, get it out of the way. You know, it's always the best-selling record, so.
So now we're talking about South by Southwest, and you guys all live in one house together. And I can see on the one hand, it will be great because you could all share the synergy together. If someone's jamming in the living room, everyone else can join in and come in, and you could hone your skills that way. On the other hand, you know, the usual roommate troubles. You could be tired of cleaning up someone's pizza crusts and dirty socks.
Yeah, so that's pretty much exactly it.
What is it like? Yeah. Is it something that's bringing you closer, or are there obstacles too?
There are definitely obstacles, but I think the positives outweigh the negatives.
Because it's really cheap to live with nine people.
It's more than that, though. It's more than that.
No, I was joshing them. I was just playing around. I like living with people. For me, personally, I've always been someone who needs like a group of people to come to me and be around me, rather than most of us are so introverted that we don't really go out of the house. So we're kind of in this perfect scenario where we can all just stay at home, hang out with each other, be totally fulfilled and stimulated by each other in different ways.
Wait, so you're a bunch of introverted musicians?
You don't say.
Do you think that's true of a lot of musicians? Or do you think, I don't know, I just assume that if you want to play before crowds of thousands, that you like being the center of attention, you like that. But tell me how that works to be an introvert and a musician.
Well, I think there's a misconception of what introvert means. Like, I love being around people. Really love being around people, but I just need to recharge at home. I mean, I think it's rare. I would say it's, I guess, scratch what I just said. I think it is rare to have this many introverts in one.
I don't know, but think about all the rock and roll. Think about all the dudes that, like, you hear so many stories about incredible nervousness from performers puking in the bathroom before every performance. I mean, at the highest levels of entertainment. I don't know. I'm not sure what the correlation is between it, but I don't know that performing is inherently social, really. I mean, especially in our culture, there's this line that's drawn in between the fans and the performers, which is kind of silly. We've always tried to, like, do what we can to break that, just to make it more of an experience. Like, we always get to play these cool shows. Like, we're playing the barn out in Spring Green. Are you familiar?
I've heard about it, but I haven't been.
It's great. It's really cool. There's no stage, so you're just right there with whatever performers you're seeing, and they bring in world-class acts, and it's about 100 capacity room. So, I don't know. I think for us, like, maybe that's the only way we can socialize with people is under the premise of, like, we're performing.
Clearly, you know, you're very close. Monica's fixing your beard as we talk.
Uh-huh. Yeah. She's our stylist.
I try.
She actually does style all of our hairs.
You guys have gotten a lot of accolades besides your great hair.
Thank you.
Stephen Thompson has said that Monica's a rising star. He saw that in you.
Man.
He's from NPR's All Songs Considered. And you shot a video in your own house, did you not?
Yes, we did.
What was that like? It looked like maybe your house was going to be trashed. There was a lot of stuff flying through the air, but what a cool video. Was that something that Zach was responsible for?
Absolutely.
Yeah, Zach directed that. We were picking confetti, like literal pieces of paper confetti, out of every nook and cranny until about a week ago. I found the last piece. It's gone now.
Oh, he says last.
Nope, still in the heater vents.
Still in the heater vents. That's probably an issue.
It was fun. It was a lot of fun to do. It was, you know, the whole idea with that was we were actually recording the audio, recording the record as we were recording the video. So it was just kind of a look into a stylized recording session, and also an opportunity to put us in a weird setting while we were recording. So often it can be so dry, just sitting in a studio where, like, our studio looks nothing like this one. You know, we don't have velvet curtains, although I really would like some.
We'll get there, Crumb.
Putting ourselves in that weird scenario where half the time there was a bubble machine blowing at your face, and half the time confetti was being dumped on you, or you had to wear some kind of thrifted woman's blouse.
He does that anyway, though.
I don't let him. That's true. We all do that for fun.
Yeah, don't we all?
So it was a good time. It was fun.
Well, it's a great video, and Zach helped, and we've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page if you want to see the inside of the storied house that we're talking about today, where all the confetti is still being found in the carpeting. And I want to talk a little bit more about the genesis of your album, because as I understand it, somebody's mom deserves a shout-out, don't they?
Yeah. Yes. Matt and Davey's mom.
What's the story about the moms who helped you get going?
She was very insistent that if we were going to move out and go live together and assumedly just party and waste all of our time, we at least had to produce 10 songs by the end of the year.
Which no one told me.
That's not true, but we can argue about that later. Okay. And eventually we told you, either way, right?
Like with a month left.
Well, so we got it done, you know?
Wait, you did 10 songs in a month?
We did 10 songs in about 2 weeks. They were mostly written. We had written the songs over the course of the year. And actually the 10th song was a song that Zach wrote. Prior to him joining the band, we lifted one of his tunes and put it on and passed it off as ours.
Nice. But you're
friends. Wiser. Yeah, he was fine with it. And I think that soon their mom was, you know, none the wiser. She's fine with that.
I love that the moms are all in on this.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of where the band is going next, do you have a grand plan as to where you want to see Fox 5 years from now?
Oh, no. I don't even know what I'm doing tomorrow, to be quite honest.
What do you mean? We're going to record our second Day Trotter session tomorrow.
That wasn't planned, but I guess we are doing Day Trotter is awesome. We don't work for them, but they are great.
I forgot
what the question was.
What we're going to do in like 5 years. I mean, that's the whole...
I just want a boat, really.
Yeah, boat. We're looking to buy
a canoe, really.
A canoe. No, I think for us, you know, we have some cool stuff scheduled for this summer. We're going to Norway.
Sorry.
In August and London, and we're going to try out Europe. I think that they're a little more warm to us, even more warm than the States are, which is really exciting. So none of us have been over there, but we've had a great response from the people we've talked to.
Really?
Yeah. Really interesting.
So you're going to where again?
Norway, Trondheim. We're playing
And
Pisteria.
They're warmer to you
they're
than they are in
us.
Your home state of Wisconsin.
That's how it always is, isn't it?
No.
No?
I can't believe that.
What do they say about prophets being respected in Madison?
I don't know.
Or your home?
I'm not sure, Crum. I guess my real answer is I'm excited to travel now that I see that is
there
an option. Like, and continue writing songs and hopefully people continue liking them. That's very exciting to me.
Amen.
Yeah.
I think to all of us, so.
That's a good response.
Right. The people will come. If you write them, they will come.
Oh, man.
Hopefully.
So.
How much musical training do y'all have? Are you self-taught, or have a lot of you had lessons?
None. Zero.
None.
Nobody here?
No, that's not true. Matteo is a storied, legendary.
Matteo's on keyboards.
He's our keyboard player. He was a vocal performance major at Lawrence. Music Conservatory in Appleton.
In the Madison Boy Choir for
That's right.
Years.
Jay Sean, his father, does instruct the Madison Boy Choir, or did.
Used to. State with jazz band.
We have a couple solo and ensemble, gold stars, but other than that.
Nice.
I think Dave quit piano when he was 3 and a half. 4?
Yeah, I was done.
4, yeah.
Oh,
so.
Man.
So it turns out that's okay. My son just quit piano, but that doesn't mean he won't be in a band.
Right.
He will regret it. Regret quitting.
Don't tell me that.
No doubt. I'm just telling him.
Force it on him.
He should be listening.
Yeah, you can play this for him. Play this interview.
I don't know. That's the thing. It's tough. You can't, obviously. My mom tried forcing me to play baseball, and I just took a nap in right field and was like,
see ya.
I got kicked off the team. Sorry, Mom.
But don't you think it's better that you can choose the things you love?
Absolutely.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yes. I quit piano for some time. And
there you go.
Yes.
Came back to it in high school and ended up going to school for that. So,
you quit piano and came back to it.
Yeah.
There you go.
Because
see?
I liked it.
Now that's a beautiful story. I like
to
hear that as a mother.
Yeah, right. No, training is great. Music is a form of folk art that anyone can do. It has been done like that for millennia. So I don't think it's required, but it is. It's interesting. There's a lot of interesting history to it. But I think that that's the kind of study you can do research your own musical family tree by yourself. And I just discovered this new band called The Beatles. Man, they had some good tunes.
Yeah.
No idea.
Producer Galen told me early on when we first met that after Paul McCartney played a video music award that the hashtag going around was "Who is Paul McCartney?" Which blew my mind. It's true.
There you go.
It's true. No. Some people don't know.
Well, that's because all the kids like John Lennon, don't you know?
Is it?
Oh yeah. They love their psychedelic music and their phasers.
Well, I don't want to offend any more Beatles fans, so yeah, let's hear more of you. What is your last song that you've got for us today?
The song is called... I'm so sorry. It's called Evil. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for being here, guys. This is called Evil. That was incredible. Thank you so much, all of you, for coming in and sharing your music today. And I wish you well with everything coming up in the future.
Thank you so much for having us.
We've been talking with the band Phox, P-H-O-X, that is. And we've had Matt Holman, Monica Martin, Matt Roberts, Zach Johnston, Dave Roberts, Chasten Van Hus, and Jason Krunfuss. And coming up, we'll talk about why you should choose those utensils carefully. It turns out they actually change the way your food tastes. Ooh. I'm Veronica Rickard, and I'm in this week with Jean Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.
Now, here's the thing, Veronica. Everybody loves pizza, or at least everybody that I know. But now I'm being told that if I eat pizza in a really noisy room, it's not going to be as good. It's going to be more bland, I guess.
You know, that's something I thought I had noticed before, but I thought it was just me. So it's nice to know that there's science behind it. And that's one of the findings from a new study in the journal Flavor. Apparently, presentation isn't just for the eyes, it's for your taste buds, too.
Science writer Christy Wilcox is here to explain some of the new research about how we perceive food. Christy, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there.
So break down some of this new research for us. What do our eyes, ears, and hands do to affect the way we taste food and utensils? I mean, a fork can make a difference.
Yes. So what we're learning over time as we do more and more studies on eating, basically, is that it really is this multisensory experience. It's not just about the taste buds or your mouth or even the smell of it. When from far away, you start to make judgments about food. You see the size of a burger, and your body is already judging how many calories are in that burger. You know, what is it going to taste like? What should I be expecting to have when I take a bite into it, right? You see something that looks soft, you expect it to feel soft. And if it doesn't, then that's going to change how you perceive the food when you actually take a bite of it. And so there's all sorts of stuff that now we're finding, from color to shape to texture to all of this, the weight, literally the weight of it in your hand, that affects what you think something tastes like.
So if it's heavy, if I lift up a fork and it's heavy, what does that influence me to think the food's going to taste like? Better or salty or what?
Usually it's more expensive.
Ah.
So, for example, with this yogurt study that Vanessa Harar and Charles Spence did, they found that when they artificially weighted spoons, so they sort of hid a weight in the spoon, people thought it tasted more expensive.
That's good news to me because I have the heaviest cutlery known to humankind. So my food tastes better. Well, what are some of the most surprising findings, Christy, from this study?
I think one of the really surprising findings was the effect of color, or at least to me. That I thought that was very interesting, that the color of the spoon, not the color of the food, but the color of the spoon affected how, to a certain extent, how salty or how sweet or how expensive something tasted. And that's, I mean, you normally don't really think about the color of your cutlery, right?
The color of the spoon will affect how it tastes? How so? Mm-hmm. Can you flesh that out a little?
So they're not really sure exactly why. But for example, when they had yogurts eaten off of a blue spoon, it tasted saltier. So what is it about the color blue? Somehow in our brains, we're wired to think that the color blue is saltier. And maybe that's due to other associations we've had, or maybe that's an evolutionary artifact of millions of years of eating things, and blue things, I guess, might be saltier. I don't know. We don't really know exactly why some of these happen, but it's very interesting that we're finding that they do.
And so when we find out this information, I mean, it is sort of intriguing, but what can we do with this to help us eat better, to help us be healthier? I mean, what good does this do society knowing that a colored spoon makes food taste saltier?
So there's some actually really practical applications to this. One of my favorite studies, for example, is that we eat more when we eat from bigger bowls, plates, what have you. So if you, say, want to lose weight, one thing that you can immediately do that makes it really easy is just buy smaller dishes. And then when you put a single portion on a plate, it looks bigger, and so you actually eat only that single portion instead of filling a giant plate.
And so has this information changed your eating habits, Christy?
Oh, absolutely. I actually, that's one that I've done. The small plate thing is real easy, and that's one that I implement. I basically eat off of salad plates now because I'm trying to watch my figure.
Uh-huh.
You know?
So is Jean.
So am I.
But yes, so yeah, I mean, I'll, that's something that I do. But now my plates are blue. Now I'm wondering what that means for my overall meals.
Now, so when you first bring this research or start talking about this, I mean, this also has that sense of something that's sort of fun. Is it hard to get people to take this seriously?
I think a lot of people will look at this kind of research and they think it's fun and interesting, but they don't, it doesn't really seem like, oh, amazing science. We've, you know, discovered some new particle or whatever it is. It seems sort of like, oh, so really, what are scientists doing in the back labs? They're just playing around with food.
So you guys get paid for that, right?
Exactly. Some people get paid for this. And it's really important, though, because it's, like I said, things about diet or for example, low sodium. Like, Americans tend to eat way more sodium than we ever should. And if we can, say, change the color of our plates or change the shape of our spoons or whatever it is, something that would then make us eat a little bit less salt, that's a good thing.
Now, to go back to the opening here, we talked about how if we eat food in a super noisy environment, that mm-hmm. it tastes more bland. Why is that? Is that because all the other senses are sort of kicked into overdrive and you can't really concentrate on your food?
You know, there wasn't a very good causal explanation for that. It's unclear exactly why it happened. It's possible that your brain is diverting more energy, say, to listening and to sound, and therefore it's not paying as much attention to the other different senses that you have. And what was interesting, though, was that the food that tasted blander also tasted crunchier. Like the sound part of the food, it seemed to be amplified by having background sound. Instead, you would think that it would be like it would taste less crunchier or be less crunchy because you can't hear it over the sound of the background. But no, people actually said it was more crunchy in loud environments. So that's sort of the paradoxical effect.
It's crunchy but bland.
Story of my life, crunchy but bland. Well, Christy, we're out of time, but thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you for having me.
And I will be eating dinner tonight in a whole new way. I'll be eating it with small bowls. I'm going to try a variety of utensils. It's going to be great. That was Christy Wilcox, science writer and contributor to Discover Magazine, and that's based in Waukesha.
And coming up next, we'll talk to two guests about a coming economic boom in the Arctic. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time. You're on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.